This is the Medicast, December 25th, 2006. Merry Christmas.
Transmitters? We don't need no stinking transmitters.
This is the Medicast, a podcast for EMS providers by EMS providers, featuring EMS news, products, tips, tricks, and commentary. So grab your gear and glove up. Here's today's show with the Podmedic, Jamie Davis.
Well, good day and welcome to the Medicast. I'm Jamie Davis, the Podmedic, and I want to thank everybody out there for listening to the show. It's a holiday season, whatever holiday you're celebrating right now. I will be celebrating Christmas with my family today or this week, depending on when you download the show. And I just want to thank all of you for checking out the show. If you're a brand new listener, welcome to the Medicast. Take a time to listen to a couple of episodes. Check out the back archives on the website at medicast.com. Or check out your feed if you've got this through iTunes or another feed service. And look at the rest of the shows out there and get a sense of what the Medicast is all about. And of course, for all of you long-term listeners, the contributors to the show, the people that are sending emails, I really, really appreciate all of your time and your effort. Your questions, your comments, your information are what make the Medicast the show that it is today, and I really appreciate it. Well, it is holiday time, and I've been busy with the family and doing a lot of things, and I'm still out there working on things for the Medicast. I've got a lot of emails and comments from all of you that have checked in with me, and I've got a couple of them that have been of particular interest. One of them from listener Daniel sent me some information on an alternative product to the vein light. Now, you may have heard in past episodes, I got a complimentary copy of the vein light or product vein light that was offered to me to review for the show. I did not offer any compensation. They sent me the product to try out for free, and I'll give an honest opinion of that. Well, Daniel sent me some information on an alternative product, a competing product called the Veinoscope. So I've contacted them, and I will hopefully, maybe they'll send me one to try out, and I can compare them side by side and give you some ideas on whether this product is worthwhile to keep in your bag of tricks, or which one might be a little better than the other, or maybe they're both the same. We'll find out. And I'll also include some more of Daniel's comments when the time comes to talk about those two products. So look for more on that probably at the end of January. If you want to contact me like Daniel did, you can send me an email at podmedic@mac.com. You can also check out the podcast website at www.medicast.com. And I can't stress that enough. You know, it's not just a site for the podcast. It's a site where I post a lot of news, information on medical studies I find that might be of interest to EMS providers, as well as just general comments and things that I turn up throughout the week. So I put about four or five posts up on the website a week in addition to the Medicast show notes. So you can check all that information out there as well as links to some other great things. And in addition to that, at the bottom of each entry, you can leave a comment. So if there's something in there that you like or dislike, you can leave a comment right there on the website at medicast.com. Additionally, there's a link in the show notes for the MobiTalk online voicemail service. MobiTalk is a service that uses your onboard microphone if you have one built into your computer, or if you have a computer you can easily plug in like a USB microphone. You can leave a link there. Just click on that link and a little recording window will pop up right in your browser and you can record it up to 2 minutes long, a voicemail comment for the show. I'll jump right off with some really good news, I guess, for us in EMS, and that is information on the new National EMS Advisory Committee. This advisory committee will report to the National Highway Transportation Safety Administration's Office of EMS and will be a 26-member panel comprised of volunteer and career providers in EMS, as well as trauma surgeon, state EMS directors, educators, dispatchers, and highway safety officials. This is going to cover a multitude of issues and is part of what we're looking for in EMS to provide a more national and unified voice for us in the federal government. The National Association of EMTs says that they are optimistic and is applauding the putting together of this particular medical advisory panel for EMS. So this is going to be coming up in the next year, and they will be looking forward to doing a lot of things in the way of providing advice to the federal government on how to support EMS better in the field. And this is something that's been a long time coming. You know, we saw this come across in front of us when the FEMA grants started coming out for local fire departments following 9/11. And yet many and most EMS services were kind of left by the wayside because there was no unified voice for us saying, hey, you know what, we're first responders and need some access to that money as well. And so this is important. The National Highway Transportation Safety Administration said that the NHTSA has a 40-year history of supporting EMS systems through partnership and collaboration with federal, state, and national agencies. And the new National EMS Advisory Council will establish a formal method for obtaining input and advice from the nation's EMS community. So I'm optimistic as well. Let's see how this pans out, and we'll find some more information on this, and I'll report on it as it becomes available. So we're out on the street, and we're out thinking we're not getting enough recognition. We're not getting enough focus on all the work we do in our communities. But, you know, there's somebody else that supports us that is not getting any recognition most of the time. That's our dispatchers. And how often do you thank your dispatchers for all the hard work they're doing? I think it's important for us to do this. And an interesting story came up at emsresponder.com that discusses a Maryland county paying the price for low 911 dispatcher pay. This happens right here in Maryland and is in Waucomico County, which is just a short distance away from where I sit in a neighboring county. And it is talking about how their pay is the lowest of Maryland's 24 jurisdictions and is actually $1,500 lower than a 2005 survey of dispatcher pay on the lowest average pay reported there. And they're seeing a 40% turnover in dispatchers in Waucomico County, which is greatly impacting their ability to get quality call taking going on and dispatching of EMS, fire, and police calls. So, you know, I think we need to remember that there's other people that are involved. I know we don't get paid enough for what we do, and I guess that's not why we do it, but dispatchers are also part of that group of people that don't get recognized and sometimes get swept under the rug when it comes budget time because they're just not very visible. I mean, you know, you don't think about your 911 dispatcher if you're a member of the public until you need them. You call, you just think it's a voice on the other end of the phone. You don't care how much they get paid. You don't care how often they're turning over in their job. You just want somebody that knows how to do what they need to do. And just like you expect quality EMS care from your EMTs and paramedics, you expect quality call taking from your dispatchers when you call 911. And we need to make sure that our whole service is getting supported from top to bottom, that we're getting good support from our medical directors, that our ERs are getting good support so that they're not overcrowded and we have a place to take our patients. Our dispatchers are getting decent pay. We're getting decent pay. We have decent equipment and protocols that are commensurate with our abilities in the field. All of these things kind of join together in giving us the total picture of 911 services. So look into what is going on in your service and stay actively involved in making sure that the public is aware of the total picture. And by working together as a group, we can all provide well for each other and making sure that the public appreciates us appropriately. Speaking of members of our service that are out of the public eye, A lot of attention has started to come up this year regarding the ongoing health problems of the 9/11 rescue workers, the people that responded to the scene at 9/11 after the towers came down, that were there amidst all of that toxic dust and worked there on the scene to participate in the rescue and recovery efforts. And recently, there was money put aside to provide healthcare treatment for these workers, many of whom had not received health coverage and were all on disability, those that were having serious issues. So a lot of that money is already starting to run out. They put aside about $40 million that was set aside by the federal government to treat these workers, volunteers, and firefighters who became ill after 9/11's cleanup effort. But it's running out very soon. Members of the Congress from New York and New Jersey have secured $75 million a year ago to pay for healthcare expenses, but most of that is running out. So what are we going to do now? Well, Senator Hillary Rodham Clinton, among others, is proposing that we have a long-term solution to the problem and that we put forward what some officials are expecting to be excess costs of $250 million a year that will go towards treating the 9/11 health workers that were working in the field there. Now, that's a lot of money, and many lawmakers are expected to balk at the cost of that figure. But that said, these workers worked in there, getting themselves dirty, working in many cases without adequate coverage and safe operating equipment. And we were not able to really look at that at the time. Yeah, a lot of people should have probably been better prepared. And I talk about this in my other podcasts on the subject. Check back in the show notes back to, I guess, 9/11. I actually put up a podcast that day. It was the Monday that was due to go up. And so you'll see my talk there about some of this issue, as well as some other things that I talk about in other news items. Senator Hillary Rodham Clinton and others have long argued to increase the federal commitment to aiding these workers. And many of them are dying. They're experiencing severe respiratory illnesses as a result of the toxic dust that they inhaled. And these people need some kind of health coverage. Some proposals that are being put forth are talking about putting forward an additional $1.9 billion to cover these rescue workers into 2011. We'll see what happens in the upcoming Congress. But, you know, in the meantime, you can check out the show notes at medicast.com. I have a link there to the United States Congress. So if you want to contact your congressman or your senator, member of the House of Representatives, you can go click the links there and you can put in your zip code and find out who your representative is if you don't know, and you can contact them directly through those websites. So I urge you to get involved and let it be known that you expect the country to take care of these heroic workers who were in there working on 9/11 to help the rescue recovery effort. Have any of you had a fibromyalgia patient or a patient that's suffering from chronic pain and wonder whether or not the pain is real? Well, I've talked about pain management here in the past, and many of you know how I feel about this. And I think I agree with some other prominent paramedics out there. Peter Canning is one of them. He talks a lot about managing pain aggressively in the field. Well, there's some evidence in a recent report out of the University of Michigan that is talking about the pain of fibromyalgia. And these doctors are saying that medical doctors and other care practitioners need to take these patients' complaints seriously, that it is not just their imagination. A quote from the article says, quote, "It is time for us to move past the rhetoric about whether these conditions are real and take these patients seriously as we endeavor to learn more about the causes and find the most effective treatments for these disorders," end quote. And that's from Richard Harris, research investigator for the Division of Rheumatology at the University of Michigan Medical School. Fibromyalgia, if you don't know, is a debilitating pain syndrome that affects 2-4% of the population, but it is often mistakenly diagnosed as arthritis or even as a psychological issue, and many patients face questions about whether their condition is real. So, what do we do about this? Well, I'll tell you. You got a patient who has pain, and you have the ability to treat that pain, you do so. And this is whether you're an EMTB or a paramedic. You have the ability to manage patients' pain. It may not be a medication, but it may be something as simple as an ice pack or proper positioning of the patient or padding voids. Hey, when's the last time you talked about padding voids? I bet it was EMT class when you were working on your practicals. We don't do that enough, folks. We don't make an effort to make sure that the lumbar spine is supported when we have patients backboarded, or that we support people that say, oh, my knees are sore. Well, you know what? A pillow tucked under somebody's knees goes a long way in the comfort zone. You know what I'm saying? So pay attention to when your patients talk about being uncomfortable or having discomfort or having pain. Ask them how much their pain level is. Assess their pain before, find out 1 to 10 where their pain sits, and then find out what makes them feel better. And it doesn't have to be giving them morphine, although I'm an advocate of using the medications we have and treating pain aggressively. But if you're an EMTB, you've got ice packs. You've got heat packs for muscle and joint pain. You've got things like repositioning and padding the patient so that they're comfortable. Helping them shift up in the seat so they're not slumped down and not sitting properly on your stretcher can go a long way to making the patient more comfortable. All of these things can be done, and then I want you to do something. Reassess their pain. Find out if it actually has improved. You may be surprised that some easy, simple things like repositioning and padding and applying ice or heat packs can make a big difference in your patient's comfort while you drive and ride to the hospital. And this goes for you drivers out there too. Pay attention to your road. Make sure you're not hitting potholes that you could have easily avoided if you were just paying a little bit more attention. Plan your route. Don't go through the traffic zone that has all of the road construction if maybe you can take a few extra minutes if you have a non-critical patient and go around the different route so that they have a more comfortable trip. So just a few thoughts on pain management and how we can make patients' lives and rides a little better. Finally, in today's news, I wanted to touch base on a Department of Homeland Security initiative to get the interoperable communications programs in place for the nation's 46 major cities and municipal areas under the Department of Homeland Security. Now, Secretary Michael Chertoff has talked about this on November 27th and wants this program solidly in place by the end of 2007. And this was a key portion of the dictate for the National Department of Homeland Security. They were to work hard on getting the nation's first responders have the ability to communicate with each other. Remember 9/11, one of the biggest issues was that fire and police couldn't talk to each other, that EMS, private EMS services were not able to communicate with public fire service and public EMS services. And there was a big talk about how we were supposed to get all of these people on board and able to communicate with each other. And this is a big initiative. 46 major cities include New York, Los Angeles, Miami, and Chicago, as well as others. And he wants not only to have this done by 2007, but he wants interoperable communications in place and available in all 50 states by the end of 2008. Now, this would give everybody the ability to communicate in a given area during a disaster and have health department and local hospital officials and federal officials all be able to talk with the local first responders on the ground and be able to coordinate efforts. Along with this is a push to institute and provide National Incident Management System compliance in that time frame as well. National Incident Management System, or NIMS, is a program whereby we take our incident management program we already understand a little bit about and take it up to the next level. And I received a question about this from a listener, probably about a month and a half or so ago. And they asked about, could I do something on National Incident Management System compliance? So I put the call out to my listenership, and you guys came through. Medicast listener Rick Rosati is a trainer for NIMS and a fire captain from western part of New York State. And he was happy enough and gracious enough to allow himself to be interviewed on the topic of NIMS compliance and what it means to EMS providers in the field. So without further ado, I'm going to turn this over to my interview with Rick Rosati. It is a telephone interview, so the quality is a little bit different than what you normally hear from me alone on the MedicCast. But it's a great interview, a lot of great information, and I urge you to listen through to it. And there will be links to some of the things he talks about in the show notes directly linked to National Incident Management System links. So check that out. Hi, I'm here with Rick Rosati, who is a paramedic and a fire captain and an instructor for the National Incident Management System. Rick, it's great to have you on the show.
Thanks for having me, Jamie.
Can you tell me a little bit about how you got into instructing National Incident Management System classes?
Well, instructing NIMS, or National Incident Management System classes, was an extension of teaching incident command system to firefighters and paramedics. Basically expanding from what they learned in basic or recruit training onto a more what I would call the adult version of incident command, which is National Incident Management System. It truly was a natural extension of where we had been for the last 20 or so years in incident command.
Now, what is National Incident Management System has really come to the forefront since 9/11 and the need to coordinate different agencies. Is this new federal push really what's driving things right now, or is it something that was going to happen as a natural course of national training levels?
I certainly think the domestic and international events on American soil, especially since September 11th, have driven the National Incident Management System. I don't think that we would have come to this point had we not had the unfortunate events of September 11th. The incident command system really grew out of fire scope, putting fire departments from different jurisdictions on the same page logistically and in conversation and terminology. The National Incident Management System strives to put not only fire departments on the same page, but includes the other traditional response groups of police and EMS, or law enforcement and EMS, and also includes the non-traditional response groups, such as hospital personnel, public works, elected officials, and that sort of thing. So the National Incident Management System is very comprehensive in comparison to the incident command system, which we've all been accustomed to.
We all kind of learn incident command as part of our training, either as EMTs, paramedics, or firefighters, and I know police officers and law enforcement learn command levels and incident command for major incidents. But I was interested to hear that you said that hospitals and local civilian jurisdictions are included in this program, which I actually was something I guess I knew but never really thought about. Have you been teaching classes to those groups, or are they finding it encouraged upon themselves to find their own training?
Well, that's an interesting question, and the answer in short is yes. We've been teaching to mainly hospital providers. It seems that public health and community health folks have really taken hold of the incident management systems and the integration with the traditional response groups and really latched on and run with it with a lot of interest, and they're really hungry for how us and fire and EMS do business. Local governments and elected officials have also bought into incident management training and NIMS training, but we really have seen the growth in the healthcare industry, especially in the emergency departments and hospital management folks. What's been impressive with that is the realization on their part, that is the hospital administrators and the in-hospital providers, their realization of what we expect from a local hospital, whether it's a level one trauma center or a community emergency department in a rural community hospital. We in the traditional response groups expect that whatever or whoever we bring to those hospitals are going to be handled regardless of scope or size of the incident. And we need to work those folks into our command structure just as we would work any other response group for knowing logistics, capabilities, and operational feasibility of taking patients to a hospital or supporting the hospital operation.
Okay. So let's start with the beginning of an incident. I talked a good deal about the Alabama bus accident, which was a mass casualty incident. And while I think some of the focus on NIMS happened right now, at least in my viewpoint, seems to focus on terror attacks, I think it's more likely to be applied in the local sector with mass casualty incidents, train derailments, bus accidents, major motor vehicle collision incident scenes. Let's start with the beginning of that. And you're the first provider on the street. What is your job in under national incident management when you get there and realize that this is way above what is a normal response requirement?
You know, Jamie, for the first person on the street, that first responder to hit the scene, they're not going to really appreciate a difference in role from what we've come to know through the incident command system. Historically, the first person that gets there recognizes a large scope event, and what do? They notify their dispatch center, they call for additional resources, and they establish some type of command or someone to be a point of contact for radio communications. Now, in the emergency medical service, that crew of two people responding on an ambulance, one person may take the command role, but they may also be triaging patients, right, surveying the scene, or doing a whole host of other duties. So the person on the street will probably do the same thing. NIMS, as it is more of a philosophy on management rather than a hands-on in management.
Okay.
Those that are familiar with incident command systems or the incident command model probably won't see a lot of difference with NIMS in the actual application. It's in the background, the philosophy, and the training that we've really seen improvement with NIMS over incident command.
Okay, so it really gels well with what we've already learned about calling for resources, setting up command, and then passing command along to higher levels of training as they arrive.
That's right.
So you said it's a philosophy. So now I'll give you for instance, in our county, and we're a rural county in Maryland and have small rural hospitals. In this county, all the fire chiefs and EMS senior officers, whether they're chiefs or captains from the different companies, went and were urged to take National Incident Management System course. But you know volunteer companies, there's a lot of turnover. And so here I am this year, I'm going to be next year's EMS chief. And
congratulations.
Well, I know. I don't know how I took that one on, but we'll see how that works out. Thank you very much. But I didn't take the class. It was offered. It was available. You know, regular folks in the fire company were invited to attend. But in the midst of continuing education classes and my podcast and everything else, I didn't go. Is my knowledge of general incident command system that I'm already using going to be enough to support me in a major incident?
The answer to that is yes and no. The experienced provider, someone that's worked in the incident command system before, that has experience with using incident command either for large or small scale events, will be able to get by. Where I think you'll need to brush up a little bit or take the NIMS classes comes into play when we have these large scale events that incorporate not only multi-jurisdictions of fire, police, EMS, but we start to bring in additional resources such as hospital providers, public works, public health, that sort of thing. And certainly when we get to the disaster level, where we're calling in or activating an emergency operations center, where we're bringing in elected officials or government officials, that's where NIMS really will come to your benefit. Now, that being said, you've hit on a couple important topics. The training for NIMS is really painless. And I know people that have said they're becoming NIMS compliant, their agency is striving towards NIMS compliance, yet they don't buy into that philosophy that I mentioned earlier. And that is to say that an agency will order its folks to sit down at the computer and take the online NIMS classes. And what often happens is one bright person sits down, whips through the online modules, takes the test at the end, prints it out, and then before you know it, everybody in the agency has taken the same test. And they really haven't picked up on the principles. Although on paper it's being NIMS compliant, that's not adopting the philosophy and truly being NIMS compliant. When an agency buys into NIMS, as directed by the government, they change the way they manage incidents, training, and the way they practice. One thing that's always stuck with me, especially with EMS providers, is when you're teaching a class to a group of EMTs or paramedics, you ask the room who has done triage before, and inevitably a couple of hands will go up, and those folks will describe a bus crash or a car accident or some other multi-patient or traumatic event where they've had to go and actually do triage. Well, my response to these people is that everybody in EMS does some form of triage, whether it's one patient or 10 patients. We identify treatment priorities, and we treat those needs of a single patient on the same priority basis as we would treating a number of patients. Firefighters do the same thing, but we just call it size up. But the problem is we only teach that in basic training to a very, very small extent. Not many paramedics, EMTs, or firefighters, when they go through their class, get many hours of incident management training. And now we're kind of seeing the downfall of that some years later and trying to bring everybody up to speed on NIMS and adopting this philosophy.
Okay, and I agree with that. I think that it's one of those things that we don't practice mass casualty incidents enough. And before NIMS came around, there was always a call to get together with your local hospital and practice mass casualty incidents, but it never seemed to gel, at least in our jurisdiction. And there was a lot of talk about it, but it never came together. And I really honestly believe it's one of those things, you know, you use it or lose it. You need to, at least for me, I need to practice things. I need to put them into practice and shake the bugs out and do it again a year or so later to make sure that I have remembered the philosophies and important strategies that I learned the first time.
That's right. To the credit of the Federal Emergency Management Agency, or FEMA, they have put together a tremendous website known as the NIMS, or National Incident Management System Integration Center. And I'm going to send you a link list of all the sites that I use for instruction, for referencing.
Great.
And this NIMS Integration Center really does lay out in no uncertain terms what the requirements are, what the legislative background on those requirements are. All the training programs are all listed there. Templates, formatted statements, formatted training is all laid out for the manager and the provider right there on the website.
Well, that's great. I'll definitely want those, because I know this whole conversation with you came about from another listener that sent me an email wanting to know more about NIMS and wasn't able to get a satisfactory answer from their supervisor. And that may be indicative of what you were talking about earlier of, yeah, we're working on it, but, you know, they didn't really buy into it. Rick, if you're trained currently under another incident command system, and there's several different incident command systems out there, how does differences between them work into NIMS? Do you have to retrain into a different system, or will the system you originally trained under lend itself to NIMS?
The system that you originally trained under most likely will aid in your upgrading to NIMS. Chances are, most providers across the country are using a very similar incident command structure, whether it's the Phoenix model or the New York City model or some variation thereof. Most places have a very similar command structure. NIMS puts that all together in a universal format that can be used by the traditional response groups as well as the non-traditional response groups. So to directly answer your question, you would have to take some retraining, and it's all laid out on the NIMS website. But your experience in prior training, things will look very familiar to you, and it'll be fairly recognizable and fairly easy to do.
Okay. Well, now there's lots of grant money out there, less for EMS than we'd like. And what I would want to know is, will NIMS compliance be something that is required, and is EMS included in that? Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, will NIMS compliance be required for EMS? I'd have to say for those agencies that receive or wish to receive federal dollars, NIMS compliance is a yes, would have to be done. One of the questions that's out there is if your fire department contracts with a commercial ambulance service or volunteer ambulance service or some other private ambulance service for transport, does your ambulance contract service have to be NIMS compliant in order for your fire department to receive money? I just can't answer that. That question is asked in almost every class I teach, and I'm not quite sure anyone has a good answer.
There's been a shift in hopefully more money coming to EMS, and we want to be able to get that grant money, and I'm just wondering, up till now, a lot of the grant money has been thrown at fire departments and encouraging them to get more training. Have you found that EMS services have missed the boat in getting some of the training that they need, and now they might be left behind because they're behind in their training in NIMS?
In my experience, I have found that EMS agencies are often left behind. I'm not sure if they're left behind, if EMS agencies are the funding loop, because they don't qualify or because they don't go after it. I'm not quite sure how to answer that. Typically, EMS agencies, at least ones that I'm familiar with here in Western New York, don't have folks that actively pursue funding on a regular basis for federal dollars. So it could be a factor of the money not being channeled to EMS or EMS not going after it. And I'm sure that's not universal across the country. I'm sure that there's you know, larger EMS agencies, especially those that are attached to a municipality or local government, are looking at this money very, very closely.
I think that kind of hits on it, unless there's something else you'd like to talk about as far as addressing just general listeners. I mean, my listeners of the podcast span people in management down to guys that are brand new in EMT school and are using the show to help them learn. And so that's a broad scope of people, but what you're really saying is that everyone needs NIMS.
That's right. If I could just leave you with a couple of thoughts. The first one would be to actually take the training, adopt the philosophy, and then practice it. All too often, we'll attend mass casualty drills or disaster drills, which are typically held on a nice sunny 70-degree day someplace, and folks spend a lot of time planning these drills. I don't want to take anything away from that, but we usually walk away with a good feeling, and we really do pat each other on the back. But what we have to do is take this incident command training or NIMS training and challenge it by working with people who we don't know, people who are outside of our traditional response group, such as hospital folks, and we really need to stress our systems, not to the point of failure and not to point out weaknesses, but to identify pieces of the planning process that need to be improved. The other thing I'd like to leave you with is actually planning, doing tabletop exercises, revising your agency's plans, making sure your agency's plans fit in with other agencies surrounding your jurisdiction or your local government's response plans, understanding each other's capabilities, and making those plans so they're generic and they take the all-hazards approach. We can't just look at this stuff for terrorism. You started off the interview asking about the bus crash that was in the media recently. And if we practice incident management system, every patient, every call, will be prepared to use that management system when the bus crash happens, when the hurricane hits, when the earthquake strikes, or, God forbid, the next terrorist attack.
Well, that's good advice for everyone. And you're going to provide me with the resources and the links that we talked about here in the show. And, Rick, I'd just like to thank you very much for contacting me. You've been a great resource for this. And I think that if there's any other questions in NIMS that come up in the future on the show, I'd like to have you back, if that's all right.
Jamie, I'd love to. I've really enjoyed your podcast. I think you're doing a tremendous service for the EMS and emergency response community. And I congratulate you.
Well, thank you very much. And that was my interview with Rick Rosati, NIMS instructor. And if you want to check out the links that he talked about, they are in the show notes at mediccast.com. Just check out the podcast category for tonight's show notes, and you'll be able to see some of the things that he's talking about. And I think it behooves all of us, whether you're a brand new provider or somebody that is in management or aspiring to management in your EMS service, you need to get out there and find a way to get your NIMS training and be compliant for your service. And I guess you heard me talking with Rick about it, but I have been elected EMS chief for my fire department this year. And so I have got that added responsibility jumped on, but I hadn't talked about that, but that also is going to be going on for me in 2007. So I think I'll be talking a little bit more about management and leadership in my podcast in the coming year as well. And National Incident Management Training certainly applies to leadership traits and management style in our current environment. So thanks again to Rick for contributing to the show. And if you have something that you'd like to share with the listeners, you can always reach me at podmedic@mac.com and let me know what it is you'd like to learn about or teach about to the listenership. There's all of us have something that we're good at and something we can share with our other listeners and make this the community that I really want it to be and that we all intend it to be. So thank you, Rick, for contributing back to the show. And that's going to wrap up this episode of the MedicCast. I want to say to all of you to have a safe and happy holiday season. Those of you that are working shifts this week or working over the holidays, make sure you watch out for yourselves and take care of your partners and your families at home and make sure that you're safe and able to stay listening to the show and out there doing what it is you like to do, running EMS in 2007. Remember to check back and contact me here at the MedicCast at podmedic@mac.com. And remember to support the MedicCast. To help support the show, there's a couple of things you can do. I always urge you to visit the MedicCast website at medicast.com and check out the stories there. Contribute comments back either by email or directly on the site. And let me know what's going on in your thought process when you read some of the things that I post up there. These comments, especially if you comment directly on the site, will be visible to other listeners and they can comment back to your comments as well. And we can get a little bit of a discussion going on about some of these topic areas. As well as that, I always appreciate those of you that have visited the MedicCast store. That's store.mediccast.com. And that's basically a link to my Amazon affiliate store. Anything you can buy at Amazon.com, you can get through the MedicCast affiliate store. And quite a few of you use that service over the holidays for some of your gift shopping. Those of you that are starting new semesters in school, if you're able to and the price is right, I don't want you to spend any more than you would at your school bookstore, but if you can find a textbook online at Amazon, you can click through my link and I'll get a little something back to support the MedicCast and the cost of hosting the show, and I appreciate that. As always, the most important thing you can do about the MedicCast is tell a friend. Share podcasting with the people you know this year in 2007. Tell them about the shows you listen to, the MedicCast, and the entertainment programs you're listening to. And let them know about the new media that's out there, the ways that people can listen to things that just aren't the mainstream junk they find on their TV or their radio. And that's important. So support podcasting this year in 2007. I will end up, as I always do, with some great PodSafe music from a band called Basic. And keeping in the holiday theme, the last week that I post a holiday song for 2006, I will end up with a song called Joy to the World, the old classic Christmas carol. You can check this out. There's a link to the Basic website in the show notes. Check out their website and their music there. And there's also links to their music on the iTunes store if you're interested in purchasing their music and supporting the band. Support the bands that provide PodSafe music. These bands make music available to podcasters without us having to pay the fees required by the radio stations and the music publishers out there. This way, the artists themselves are able to contribute directly to getting their music out there without going through a middleman. And podcasting is a strong supporter of that. So support these artists by showing your support and purchasing their music if you enjoy the songs that I play here on the show. That's going to wrap it up. This is the last podcast for the Medicast 2006. I'm Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic. Scene safety, BSI.
Joy to the world, the Lord.